south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Hey, let's start out with a boots-on-the-ground story with a lot of overtones to it. Phoned up my favorite Latin dentist the other day for an appointment, and the receptionist said, "Is it an emergency?" I said, "No." She said, "What day would you like to come?" I said, "How about Friday morning?" She said, "Oh, no, Friday doctor doesn't work in his office. He works at the public hospital." And, you know, immediately the average gringo who hasn't been down in Latin America too long is thinking, "Public hospital? Heard those are pretty crappy. What's my dentist doing working at a public hospital? Something wrong with that guy?" I heard you have to bring your own gloves and disposables. That's not right. I gotta talk to him about that. But, you know, I've been down here 27 years plus now, and I know lots of good-hearted dentists and physicians donate their time at public hospitals simply because they want to help the disadvantaged. They ask for nothing else. They just do it as a public service. Come on, how many physicians and dentists do you know donate their time like that up in the States? Totally screws up the golf game, you know? However, when I popped in the office, we were just making small talk, and I said, "Hey, Doc, what do you do at the public hospital on Fridays?" He says, "I do cleft palate operations on poor people." By the way, he's a U.S.-trained oral surgeon, so he can do surgeries like that. Then I said, "It's free, huh? Well, isn't there some cost to it? I mean, you've got surgical equipment and all that." He said, "There's a worldwide organization of surgeons that people can donate to, and we do the surgeries for free, and the foundation takes most of the dough and flies in young kids that could never afford to have the surgery from wherever they are to the nearest center where those operations are performed." Then he said, "You know, in fact, last Friday was a really sad kind of day for me." And I said, "Sadder than usual? I mean, little kids born with cleft palates, that's pretty depressing." He said, "Oh, no, that part's cool because, you know, we can make tremendous advances on a tiny little kid that's only 2 or 3 months old. That's the best time to get them." He said, "At that age, they respond so well, not like when you get them when they're 12 or 13 or 15 years old. Then you can almost never get a perfect or even great result. But," he said, "when you get him at 10 weeks, like the kid he had on Friday." And I said, "What, 10 weeks? He said, "Yeah, he flew to Guatemala City all the way from Venezuela to get the operation done." I said, "He fly with a nurse or something?" He said, "No, with his dad." Then I said, "I assume the foundation pays for the flight and the accommodations and stuff, right?" He said, "Yeah." Then I said, "Okay, tell me the sad part, besides the fact you had to operate on a 10-week-old kid." "Well," he said, "they only come in for a few days, get the operation and leave. And the dad," he said, "came with two giant empty suitcases." And he said, "You know, Venezuela's short of everything." And I said, "Yeah, I suppose he brought two empty so he could stock up on what, toilet paper?" And he said, "No, it's a lot worse than that." Turns out as soon as he arrived, he'd gone to one of the big supermarkets and bought enough powdered milk to fill those suitcases to maximum capacity. Because, he said, there was just no milk at all that you can buy anyway in Venezuela. So let that be a lesson to all you Bernie Sanders socialists out there. In fact, it's so hard to believe anybody over the age of 40 could even think of buying into that concept. You know, you can forgive young kids, adolescents, and college kids. Socialism sounds so great, right? By the way, did you ever read the story of Karl Marx? You know, he came from a rich family and lived like a prince in London, you know. Have you ever heard that before? A socialist or a communist expounding on the glories of everyone sharing things equally? Meanwhile, he or she lives a privileged life? That never happens, right? By the way, I might have mentioned this, but I've been routinely getting emails from people living in Venezuela. But suddenly, in the last 3 or 4 months, the ones who were sending me regular emails stopped. There could be a number of reasons for that, and unfortunately, most of them are probably not good. Anyway, here's an email from a Venezuelan guy you just have to hear. He says, "As of my writing, $5 equals 1,319,015 Venezuelan bolivars. 2 months ago, $5 was worth more than twice as much, 545,450 Venezuelan bolivars." Then he says, "Like in the U.S., people here are used to buying groceries once a month or every 2 weeks. Not so anymore. Now," he says, "almost everyone has to buy food by the day, and hopefully enough for that day. because no one can afford to buy groceries for longer than that. In addition, he says, regulations on food now prevents us from buying enough to last a week, much less a month. That would be illegal. The so-called basic goods basket, la canasta básica, which is the amount of money required to buy basic goods for a month, is priced at about 8 to 10 times more than anyone except people working in government or the black market can make in a month. So with the government's minimum wage, you're only able to buy 6 to 10 meals a month. That's without figuring in electricity, water, garbage, cable, telephone, internet, school, clothing, etc. As a result, he says, now people spend their days thinking about what line they're going to be standing in tomorrow, which is going to be smaller, which will be larger, what time of day. You often hear, for example, I have to go to so-and-so store tomorrow because they're going to be selling so-and-so item. Tuesday is sugar day, so I better get there early. I understand that's how it was in Soviet Russia before the wall came down. Then he says, it used to be people in my social class, the ones that are able to go to college or private schools, used to drive to the market. But now we can't even drive to the stores that we need to buy these items at because our cars are without maintenance. They're defunct and cannot be repaired. Nobody has the money to buy the parts. Sure, gas, petrol, and diesel are very cheap. We can buy that by the tankful. But if the car doesn't work, oh well, you walk. But that's dangerous these days. Make no mistake about it, nowhere in Venezuela is safe to walk anymore. Then he says, due to restrictions and regulations on what you can buy and such, a new group of sleazy entrepreneurs has emerged. They come in and make money off the rest of us because they find goods at regulation maximum, buy them all, then they resell them to the rest of us at way more expensive prices than originally offered. Kind of like ticket scalpers. So again, almost all families, except for the ones who are connected somehow to government, or actively trading in the black market, are rationing their eating. In other words, you don't buy what you want to eat or what you can afford, but what's available, whether you like it or not. And when you're hungry, you can't afford to be picky. Here's a bit of my history. He says, I was born in Venezuela, and as a 17-year-old, about 8 years ago now, through a quite harrowing experience, I was smuggled out with my mother, and we built a life for ourselves in the United States. My father, along with my other relatives and siblings, stayed behind in Venezuela. They didn't want to leave the family, but wanted me and my mother to try, perhaps for a better life up in the States. Then he says, despite the fact that I'm out of Venezuela now, the majority of my family lives there, and I have a hard time with that. I couldn't send money to them, nor could I send them goods because the Venezuelan postmen are notorious for going through packages and letters and pocketing whatever they think is valuable. So you can't send money. Then, somehow, I was introduced to Bitcoin. Bitcoin was anonymous. The Venezuelan government couldn't intercept that mail. It didn't go through mail. It was digital mail. Well, I saved up and visited my family in October 2017 and set them up to receive Bitcoins from me and taught them how to sell it. So, whenever they could, they would use some of the Bitcoins I sent them and sold just enough through a place called localbitcoins.com and bought plenty of goods, as much as they could. For example, 15 US dollars worth of Bitcoin would give them enough to fund food and other goods for an entire month. Yes, you heard right, 15 bucks. And they're a family of eight. And don't be confused about the ups and downs of Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies. It doesn't matter what price Bitcoin is at. It's always readily accepted and highly valued. But in order to buy food necessities, they'd have to change their Bitcoin to the local bolivar. And they did, through that local Bitcoins exchange. They'd sell just as much as they needed in a month, as inflation made that money lose half of its value in just a few weeks. So they'd make the change and immediately buy about a month's worth of food. So when people talk about Bitcoin being a fad, being useless, being false, an unsubstantiated, unbacked up fantasy, well, guess what? Through the use of Bitcoin, I was able to send money to my family and they could actually use it to survive as middle class people. Meanwhile, all their neighbors were falling into poverty. And now I'm 25 and still living with my mother. Up in the States, we are the lifeline for our family in Venezuela. I have a job that allows me to have a little extra than I need, even though it's not much. plus I'm going to school. So whatever extra money I have, every 2 weeks, I take it along with part of my paycheck and buy more Bitcoin. You won't believe it, but I've been able to send enough altcoins and Bitcoins that way to make my family in Venezuela and six other families survive. All that on about $100 to $300 US a month that I convert into cryptocurrencies and send. And wouldn't you know it, my family, the good but frustrating people they are, still don't use most of the money they've converted from my Bitcoins and altcoins. They give it to others in need in the neighborhood so they can survive too. Then he says, one big point of my account here is that you can hate Bitcoin and all the cryptocurrencies all you want. You can call it a bubble, call me stupid for investing in it, laugh at me, say I'm a fool, but the use of Bitcoin and its decentralized nature has allowed my family and a few others to live, survive, and not starve. So despite a tyrannical government, my friends and family can still have a small living and have some control of their lives. So I must thank Bitcoin, whoever developed it, and all of its users for me being able to do this and pay forward my luck to other members of my family and humanity. Wow, me Johnny again. You gotta admire that guy. He's got a very big heart and it's in the right place. So who's laughing at Bitcoin now? And now on the same sad theme, there's another article here that a longtime listener just sent me. It's translated out of one of Colombia's biggest newspapers. It says, the 1998 election of President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela led to a radical new structure for the fishing industry. Now, everybody rightly thinks Venezuela's biggest industry is oil. But fishing, too, has always been huge, though it gets almost no press. Anyway, when he got in office, Chavez nationalized it and expropriated hundreds of millions of dollars in the form of ships, ports, shipyards, and canning factories. In doing this, he promised he'd retrofit the fish processing plants to accommodate small-scale fishermen. In 2008, Venezuela then introduced a joint venture with Cuba, known as Socialist Joint Venture Industrial Fisheries of the Bolivian Alliance. Whoa. Chavez promised that this company, loaded up with seized assets, would eliminate the chain of intermediaries so that fish products at accessible prices were available to low-income populations. But this was not to be. The fishing industry soon withered under Chavez and then under Nicolas Maduro, who succeeded Chavez in 2013. Soon came the first calamity. The giant warehouse in Goria burnt down and was never rebuilt. Second calamity, the ship repair facilities were shuttered after a few years in government hands due to mismanagement and labor problems. Oh, what a surprise. Then it says, Venezuelan ships not seized by the government were quickly reflagged in Nicaragua, Panama, and Ecuador, and much of the government fleet that couldn't escape the country in time sit idle in ports in Venezuela, waiting for repairs and parts that will never come. Then it says, from 554,000 tons of fish caught in 2007, the year before Chavez started his so-called socialist fishing revolution. Well, turns out, socializing the fishing industry was so successful, insert laugh track here. Guess what? By 2015, that number had dropped to around 40% of the previous number, to 220,000 tons. That's according to the government's own figures, the Caracas-based Foundation for Sustainable and Responsible Tuna Fisheries. Then, it says in 2015, seven major tuna processing plants declared a state of emergency, citing a chronic shortage of fish and continuous labor and management problems. Hey, me Johnny again. I guess that calls for more government. How about a law demanding more fish enter the nets? Hey, don't laugh. There probably is a law like that already. Anyway, it says 3,000 workers then lost their jobs, according to Jorge Bastardo, union leader for La Gaviota, canning plant in Cormaña. Yeah, if you're listening closely, his name is Bastardo. That means bastard in Spanish. Man, he must really have got his ass whooped as a kid. But I digress. Hey, would you call that a digression? Anyway, even when tuna was brought to shore, it says, aluminum, for all you Brit listeners, that would be aluminium, was in such short supply that the central cannery was converted into what the government dubbed the pouchery, because the government decided to switch the canning process from aluminum to plastic bags. Well, that failed too, due to lack of market testing. Yep, the public never warmed to the idea of buying their tuna in see-through plastic bags that didn't preserve the tuna all that well either. Yuck. However, now in 2018, with Venezuela in extreme crisis, former fishermen are dealing in a new commodity, sailing back and forth to the English-speaking country of Trinidad, which is only 10 miles off the Venezuelan coast. So, believe it or not, the hottest commodity today in Venezuela is diapers. So, every day, dozens and dozens of smugglers are dealing in boxes of, get this, Huggies and Pampers. They barter for the stuff with Venezuelan gas, which they get from 5 to 30 cents a gallon. So, in Trinidad, they trade the gas for three times what they paid for it in goods. And demand for the trade is so high, in Trinidad, there are waiting lists. Says Karen Kubian, working the diaper arbitrage via online sales, says I can trade diapers for medicine all day long. She says today in Venezuela, diapers are like bars of gold. Now people are getting paid in dollars, diapers, gas, and cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. She says Huggies was a diaper brand that never existed in Venezuela before, but now it's a household word. Turns out, she said, to be rich, all you need is a closet full of toilet paper and diapers. But the diaper arbitrage trade does not come without big risks, she says. You have to be on the lookout for cops who will pull you over and steal your diapers and your boat motors. Yeah, meet Johnny here now. Can't you just see it? Guy pulls a gun on you and says, this is a stick-up. Your diapers are your life. Oh, man. So she says every night when she pulls her boat in to the dock in Venezuela, she unscrews her propellers and removes the outboard, making it much harder for cops and thieves, same difference, to get away with the goods or the boat. All right, so there you have it, another very grim story coming out of Venezuela, where under socialism, it's true, everyone's equal, equally miserable. Unless, of course, you're working for the government, into cryptocurrencies, working for the black market, or in diaper arbitrage. Which brings us full circle back to part two of the rant I started last week on what's happening in Nicaragua. So far in street protests, more than 60 people have died at the hands of the military and Nicaraguan police. Most of the dead and injured college students who started protesting last month after President Daniel Ortega ordered cuts in pensions and Social Security. You see, the students know he's become a billionaire, one of the richest men on the continent, and they also know that in 2014 he scrapped presidential term limits so that he can remain president forever. They also know his government's stacked with relatives and friends who are also millionaires. How'd that happen and why didn't anybody notice that before? Well, that's because, as you might remember, 5 or so years ago, when nobody really cared much what was happening in little Nicaragua, just a poor banana republic north of Costa Rica, right? Crappy internet, bad infrastructure, terrible roads. Well, then if you remember, the Chinese came in and said they were going to build an alternative to the Panama Canal. They estimated it would cost around $50 billion. So they came in, they mapped out the routes, went into the municipalities and checked out the owners and the evaluations of the land they'd have to buy. And of course, along the way, they had to grease Ortega's palms to the tune of tens of millions. That kept him, his wife, his family, his friends in major dough. They didn't even have to steal from the tax coffers. However, just in the last 2 years, things have changed drastically, you know. The Chinese plan wasn't going to cost $50 billion after all. It was going to cost about twice that. And the Chinese guy with all the money, well, his investments kind of petered out, and he no longer could get the $50 billion together, even if that's what it would have cost. The big mistake was they assumed property values as they were stated in the municipalities. What the Chinese didn't know was that property values in Latin America are always registered at a tiny fraction of their real worth for tax purposes. Now, suppose you had a factory and you want to buy some land to get access to a river or whatever. You've singled out a piece of land, you go down to the land registry, find out who the owner is, make him an offer. But he'd laugh at you if you offered him the price the land was registered at in the county records. So the Chinese, when they came through to map out the canal, they based their estimates on the land they'd have to buy up on fair market value in the municipality, which, like I said, isn't fair value. It's more like a land valuation from back in the 1930s or 40s. All right, so long story short, the canal will never be built. So in the last year or two, the Chinese have been pulling back, meaning Ortega's palms are no longer being greased. But his princely lifestyle and all the family and friends and parasites feeding off him must go on, which is why some months ago he announced he was cutting pensions and Social Security. Yep, belt tightening, you know, not his belt, of course, which drove the students into the streets to protest not only those actions, but also demanding freedom of expression, the lifting of censorship, etc. After all, everyone there knows he controls the press completely. Now, I gotta tell you, I've been to Nicaragua a number of times. When I'd ask people, rich, middle class, poor, shoeshine boys, what they thought of Ortega, none of them would say a bad word about him. But they also had that look in their eyes that they'd better not say anything bad about him. Because the guy does rule with an iron fist. And talking dirt about Ortega is no way to advance in that country. And it seems the population's finally had enough and are taken to the streets. Oh, and if you heard the last show, you heard me mention he's a sociopath, probably a psychopath. Which is why I never gave the complete thumbs up for expats living in Nicaragua. Listen to this. According to the Miami Herald, it says, Ortega's stepdaughter, Zolamerica Narvez, stunned the country in the late 1990s when she announced that the head of the Sandinista National Liberation Front, President Daniel Ortega, sexually abused her for almost 20 years, starting when she was age 11. However, a Nicaraguan judge ruled that her claim came too late for criminal charges because of Nicaragua's statute of limitation. It had run out. Then it says Narvez, now in her late 50s, daughter of Ortega's longtime partner Rosario Murillo, says she was molested and raped repeatedly by Ortega, who dragged her along on diplomatic trips and forced sex on her. Then it says Narvez's accusations had been continuously stalled by higher courts. Because as the president and member of Congress, Ortega enjoys immunity from criminal prosecution. And it says, in a final move, Ortega gave up his congressional immunity to face charges, only to be dismissed by First District Judge Juana Mendez barely a week after receiving it. Anyway, meet Johnny again. You know, that happened a long time ago, back in the late 1990s, so people forget. I just want to remind you what a pustulant scumbag he really is. Though some might say that actually qualifies him as presidential material. And for those of you who don't know your Central American history, you remember Reagan and the Contra scandal, right? Well, after that debacle, Daniel Ortega continued governing the country without being president. Then in 2008, suddenly there were cases of dead farmers and peasants in the countryside. Meanwhile, in the cities, people knew next to nothing about the extrajudicial killings that were going on. Bottom line, there's no way this guy is going to let go of power until he croaks. And the one thing I got to admit, he's been able to keep the crime rate really low. It's the lowest in all of Central America. Because, you know, if you're a gang member with a neck tat in Managua, Nicaragua, you know if you get caught doing anything wrong, you'll just disappear. Which is why so many Nicaraguan gangbangers migrate to the U.S. But there's another thing that bothers me about Nicaragua. Citizens and residents are not allowed to own guns. And I don't know about you, but a country that does not allow you to defend yourself, well, it might be a very nice vacation spot, but I wouldn't want to live there. All right, moving on to some disappointing news from Panama. It says here in this article I just got yesterday, in the first 3 months of 2018, new construction in Panama fell by 40% compared to the same period in 2017. The biggest quarterly drop in construction ever recorded. Then it says, added to this discouraging data is the problem of the strike in the sector, which has halted construction work since April 18 on major projects, affecting the expansion of the Tucumán International Airport in Panama City and Line 2 of the new Panama Metro. All right, me Johnny here again. As far as that huge drop in construction starts, in the last few months, Panama has also had an unprecedented drop in the sales of new cars. Now, do you think that this bad economic news has something to do with the fact that in the last 4 years, the amount spent on government workers and government bureaucracy has almost doubled? In other words, the growth of cancerous government bureaucracy in Panama has been growing at the rate of 25% a year. And the only way to pay for that? Increased taxes and borrowing. Now, news like that, the unbridled growth of government, tends to scare the hell out of investors. But you knew that already, right? Yep, as for my opinion of Panama, a nice place to visit, but wouldn't want to live there either. Besides, it's dead hot all the time. They've got no altiplano. All right, speaking of disappointing news, you've heard me say many times that you really must try to get your permanent or temporary residency going in a Latin country soon because laws are changing and they're always making things harder. Of course, it's the U.S. leveraging these countries because they don't want the sheep to leave the barn. Why would they? You know, I've always been big on getting your temporary or permanent residency in Guatemala, whether you live there or not, because then it leads in 5 years to a passport and nationality. Well, as it turns out, Guatemala is not immune from tightening up their laws, and they just made it a little more difficult to get permanent residency right away. Now, you've always been able to get permanent residency by having Social Security income over $1,000 a month, or a disability or pension payment over $1,000 a month. Then you could apply for permanent residency and achieve it, no problem. But there also were a few other options, a few more little-known ways to get on board with permanent residency in Guatemala right away. And one was to show a monthly trust income payment of $1,000 or more a month, or even a recurring monthly income rental payment of $1,000 or more a month would qualify you for permanent residency. Well, the new ruling says for permanent residency, they'll only accept Social Security payments and pension and disability payments. No more trusts or continuous rental income. So then what do you do if you're not getting Social Security, a pension income, or a disability income check? And you want to get permanent residency in Guatemala so you can get that passport and nationality in 5 years. Well, not to worry. All that means is you'll have to apply first for temporary residency, which is dead easy, by the way. And after a year, you apply for permanent residency and you're in. So all it does really is add an extra year or so on your way to getting Guatemalan nationality and a passport. Because the way it works, you have to have 5 years of permanent residency before you can apply for that passport. So if you're interested, do apply for temporary residency. You don't have to show any proof of income at all. All you need is that police report, marriage certificate if you're married. They have to be apostilled in your state, of course, and you do that through your State Department. Then you hook up with a Latin lawyer in Guatemala, and he becomes your sponsor and facilitator. He does all the rest of the work, and you just go in and sign some papers, photos, fingerprints, that's it. So as mentioned, little by little, they're tightening the requirements for permanent and temporary residency in most all Latin countries, meaning you better act now. Oh, and by the way, you can still get in on the early bird discounts for my Expat Insider Seminar coming up in July 2018. You know, you can kill two birds with one stone there, too. You can apply for a permanent or temporary residency, whichever suits your circumstances. So for all the details and info, just go to www.thenewexpat.com and click on Johnny's Seminar link. And remember, I'll be running those early bird discounts until June 1st. Then the price goes back up to normal. Around $500 more per person. You've been listening to the Expat Files Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy. Nos vemos.